The committee now resume its deliberations. We'll now call upon the Honorable Janice Mabee, Chairman of the Soxhlu Atoll Indian Tribe, Darrington, Washington.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of the Soxhawatl Tribal Indian Tribe in support of clarifying the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 through H.R. 3742. In February of 2009, the Supreme Court issued the decision in Carcieri versus Salazar that is creating significant confusion in an important area of federal Indian law, the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. The Supreme Court overturned 70 years of long-standing interpretation and held that the phrase "now under federal jurisdiction" limits the Department of the Interior's authority to provide benefits under the IRA to only those tribes under federal jurisdiction in June 8, 1934. The passage of the IRA in 1934 marked a dramatic change in federal Indian policy. Congress shifted from policies intended to destroy the Indian tribes to in favor of legislation to revitalize tribal governments and Indian culture and restore tribal lands bases that have been decimated by prior federal policies. The Carcieri decision is at odds with Congress's intent to restore tribal self-determination. In particular, this decision runs contrary to Congress's intent in the 1994 amendments to the IRA, which provides equal treatment to all Indian tribes, regardless of how or when they received federal recognition. The Soxhawatl tribe is a tribe that has been adversely impacted by this confusion. We are located in the Cascade Mountains of Northwest Washington near the confluence of the Sauk and the Sewattle Rivers, where we have lived for countless generations. The tribe has adjudicated rights under the Point Elliott Treaty, signed by Saku Mehu. In 1913, Congress appropriated funds for the purchase of lands to be held in trust for the Soxhawatl tribe. Long before there were any white people in the area, we lived on both sides of the Sauk River at Sauk Prairie. This was the site of one of our major villages. However, in the 1880s, the United States gave our fertile lands at Sauk Prairie to non-Indians who burned our longhouses that had stood there for generations, leaving our people landless and scattered. Many tribal members, including my great-grandparents, retreated to the more remote lands up the Sewattle River, where some members built homes. I am the great-great-granddaughter of Captain Moses, a hereditary chief of the Sauk Sewattle. I grew up on the Sewattle River on a trust allotment which the United States, in an effort to address the displacement from our land, issued patents to us in the early 1920s. This was long before the passage of the IRA in 1934. I vividly remember bathing every morning in the icy glacier runoff of the Sewattle River, hiding in huge cedar root baskets woven by my great-grandmother, who helped raise me, learning to gather and weave and skin game. We lived by fishing, hunting, and gathering. In addition to the destruction of one of the Soxhawatl tribe's major villages, the tribe suffered in another way. Ignorance by some led to the belief that the Soxhawatl were not a separate tribe. We existed deep in the Cascade Mountains, a uniquely distinct tribe referred to by the BIA as a traditional tribe. Little was known about our people, and non-researchers for their convenience, often lumped us in with other tribes. But over the decades, the tribe continued to exist and to live in the areas of its homeland, despite the challenges not faced by the larger tribes that were given substantial reservations. In 1972, letter from the deputy commissioner, the tribe was described as having an organizational status that was traditional in nature. On April 6, 1935, the tribe was voted to adopt the IRA. In 1975, the tribe adopted a constitution and was approved by the Secretary of Interior under the IRA. In 1982, two small parcels of land totaling 23 acres were taken into trust for the tribe and designated as our reservation. The land, however, is broken into two parcels, miles apart, and is insufficient for the tribe's housing, for tribal government facilities, and for economic development, and is threatened by floods from the Sauk River, which has been designated as wild and scenic. Despite the treaties dating back to the mid-18th century, despite the 1913 congressional appropriation, despite the allotments dated to the earliest 20th century, and despite an April 6, 1935 vote by the tribe to accept the IRA in order to organize under the act, the Sauk Sahuatl tribe is being adversely impacted by the carcerary decision. What more do you want to do to us? And now, because of the confusion of the carcerary decision, and unwillingness of the regional solicitor to make decisions without written guidance from the Department of Interior, a simple fee-to-trust application for 1.64-acre parcel of land adjacent to our reservation has been put on hold. The Sauk Sahuatl tribe does not have a casino. We are simply trying to acquire enough land to provide homes for our members, and sites for tribal governmental facilities and economic development so that our tribal members and their families can obtain employment and receive tribal government services near their homes. We have built 20 homes.
If the gentlelady would try to terminate her testimony, your time has expired. You may finish up with a couple sentences.
We have built 20 homes on our reservation, but they are insufficient to meet our tribal needs. It is crucial to clarify that the IRA is not related to Indian gaming, and Indian gaming is regulated under the Gaming Regulatory Act, where Congress restricted gaming to lands in 1988. This issue is much broader. The IRA is a toolbox organized for tribal communities and buildings economic growth. We are concerned that these tools are weakened and that the Indian reservations and cities continue and states that surround them need the economic development the most.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Your entire testimony will be made part of
Thank
the
you.
Record. Our next witness is the Honorable Sandra Kleinberger, chairwoman of the Stillaquamish Tribe of Indians, Arlington, Washington.
Good afternoon, Congressman Gildee, Ranking Member Hastings, and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me here today to provide testimony to the committee on a critical issue confronting all of Indian country. Addressing the Supreme Court decision of Carcieri versus Salazar, my name is Sandra Kleinberger. I am the chairwoman of the Stillaquamish Tribe of Indians. Our tribal community supports both H.R. 3742 and H.R. 3697 because we firmly believe that carcerary was wrongly decided, and more importantly, that it established highly problematically and ultimately unworkable American Indian policy. Carcieri does not technically apply to Stillaquamish, although it has created legitimate issues for us. The case has created uncertainty amongst state and local governments, what their relationship is with tribal governments. The decision has provided opponents of Indian tribes with a base to hold or prolong tribal trust status applications. The case has potential to create unnecessary and expensive litigation for tribes across the nation. A little history about my tribe and who we are. My great-great-grandfather was Chief Chattis. He signed our treaty, the Point Elliott Treaty, in 1855. My grandmother was the late Chief Esther Ross, who traveled these hallways, who traveled to Washington numerous times, over 50 years of her life. When she grew up, she didn't know she was Native. She was 19. She found out she was Native. She came back to the Stillaguamish Territory to regain the Stillaguamish tribe. So one day, her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and generations after would have an identity. Her dream was to have land for housing, have the reservation, have the generations that were to come know the hunting, know the fishing, know the history, and know the culture. There's many tribes that have the economic development part taken care of. Our tribe is bringing back the history. This year was our first year of having this first salmon ceremony since generations past. And it was a remarkable sight to see our tribal members and our young children coming out, learning the songs, learning the dances, trying to keep our culture of our tribe alive. Like many tribes across this great nation, United States of America, our culture is foremost, the number one importance to every tribe. Carcerary decision impacts it in so many ways. For tribes that are treaty tribes that are not impacted directly, there still is the uncertainty of what can happen if we put in that application. What issues will come about? What problems are going to be caused from this? The same issues that we are dealing with are the same issues that our grandparents and great-grandparents dealt with already before us. We are here asking your help, asking you to help pass this. We're here asking you to understand the importance of this, not only for our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come, to make sure that this here doesn't cause a historical issue for them. Mr. Chairman, ranking member and committee members, our tribe has created many different programs. We have a buffalo to help with our diabetic prevention program, help supplement for our elders, transportation program to help our elders get to their medical, help our tribal members that do not have vehicle or license to be able to get to work, trying to make them more self-efficient. We also have tribal members that we have to house in hotels because we have no land yet for a reservation, for housing. This is not right. This is not part of what my grandmother's dream was for our tribe, her people. One person alone fought to get this tribe together. Amongst many other tribes have the same type of story of history. My goal for our tribe is to make sure that our history and our culture is brought back. Being able to have land and put it into trust without problems is what we need. We need this to be able to not worry about how we're going to do our housing, how we're going to protect our burial sites, and being able to have a clinic or a court system so our tribal members are protected. Right now, the way our tribe is set up, our court system is not on trust land. We have very little trust land. So when something happens, a domestic problem, the county can't help because they're native. And there's only parts of trust land that they can cover. This affects a wide variety of issues, not only for our tribe, but for other tribes even though we are not directly affected. As a Native American, issues in Indian country affect every Native, no matter if you're federally recognized or not. That is part of being a Native American.
Again, lady, you could take another minute or so to finish up her testimony.
I thank you for the opportunity to come here today and share my story with you. In addition, my oral testimony, I have submitted a written testimony to this committee with more detail. I am walking in the footsteps of my grandmother, Chief Esther Ross. And well, they are too large for me to fill. I am compelled to be here to help finish the work she started in the same halls, in the same buildings. Unfortunately, Providence has brought me to D.C. to fight a battle similar to what she fought nearly 30 years ago. As a designated leader of my tribe, I ask you to assist us in declaring once and for all that all Indian tribes are equal by passing H.R. 3742 and H.R. 3697. Thank you.
Thank you. Your entire testimony will be made part of the record. Attorney General Blumenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I want to thank the committee for giving me this opportunity to speak on behalf of the state of Connecticut and more than 20 attorneys general who also submitted an amicus curiae brief to the United States Supreme Court written by Connecticut in connection with the Carcieri matter. And I want to say that I appear or speak with some reluctance after such powerful presentations from leaders and chairpeople of the Native American community. And in Connecticut, we have two very distinguished and eminent tribal nations, the Mohegans and the Mashantucket Pequots. And I differ with them respectfully on the issues that are presented by this legislation. I want to say at the outset that I not only respect their views, but certainly am deeply moved by their stories. And I respect also the principle of sovereignty. And for 18 years as Attorney General, I have fought and argued that the principle of sovereignty on Native American reservations is entitled to respect. It is the law. It is congressional action made law for all Americans. I'm here to oppose these measures because of my respect for the principles of sovereignty and the practical impacts of land into trust, fee to trust decisions, practical impacts that we articulated to the United States Supreme Court as chief legal officers of our states, practical impacts that involve loss of taxation, loss of enforcement avenues regarding environmental laws and land use regulations, very severe impacts that are not only lasting, but in most cases, forever, as they should be in most cases. And I was interested earlier to hear the testimony from the Department of Interior as to land going from trust into fee. I'm unaware of that ever happening, and I would be interested in those instances of it happening. But I would submit respectfully that those cases are the exception rather than the rule, and they should be the exception rather than the rule. These decisions are immensely and profoundly significant. They are a loss of a substantial measure of sovereignty over areas of land within our states where enforcement obligations are supremely important, and they raise questions about jurisdiction, criminal and civil, that are enduring. I believe that there are better alternatives to these measures, and I outline them in my testimony. I believe that the current system that now prevails in the wake of Carcieri, where Congress has the power to grant fee into trust should prevail for pre-1934 tribes as well as post-1934 tribes, thereby recognizing, as the previous speaker said, the equal position of all federally recognized tribes. Congress has this responsibility, and it should take back control. And I say that because I believe, and I think you will see it in litigation, and that was referenced earlier this morning, a challenge to the Department of Interior's authority to make these decisions and to the legality and constitutionality of those decisions as an unlawful delegation of congressional power. And I think Congress should alone exercise that responsibility. If the decision is made to continue with the Department of Interior, there need to be drastic, far-reaching reforms. The current process is lawless. I use that word advisedly. It sounds like a strong term, but it is lawless. It is without standards, guidelines, any kind of congressional direction, legally, to constrain the unbridled discretion of the Secretary of Interior. With time, if I had it here, I could describe to you our fight in Connecticut, litigation spanning a number of years because of that unbridled discretion, as well as other instances where decisions have been delayed or land into trust denied to the disadvantage of tribes because of those standardless and discretionary decisions. I have the utmost respect for Secretary Echohawk, one of my former colleagues, as well as Secretary Salazar, another former colleague, and I hope they will reform the process on their own. But I would urge, as I do in my testimony, that standards be adopted to provide notice, information, a right to be heard, improvements in the standards and the process that are absolutely vital if the administrative process is to continue a drastic, far-reaching overhaul of that process as it exists now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Attorney General. Our next witness is Mr. Stephen Woodside, Sonoma County, on behalf of the California State Association of Counties, Sacramento, California.
Thank you, Mr. Kildee, Mr. Hastings, and may it please the committee. Thank you for hearing from local government here today. My name is Stephen Woodside, and I serve as county counsel for the county of Sonoma. Some of you may associate the name Sonoma with great wine or with 100 miles of spectacular coastline north of the Golden Gate Bridge. But you may not know that the word Sonoma is from the Pomo language and has been translated into English in various ways. My personal favorite translation is that Sonoma means a gathering place of nice people. Speaking of nice people, we have 5 federally recognized tribes in Sonoma County. 2 of the tribes have continuously resided on lands held for their benefit by the federal government since the 1930s, perhaps earlier. Another 2 tribes were recognized as a result of lawsuits, one in 1983, one in 1991. And the 5th tribe was recognized directly as a result of an act of Congress in the year 2000. My office has been in litigation with, has negotiated with, and participated in administrative proceedings involving these tribes and tribal trust lands. There are, at the present time, 2 applications to place land into trust. The Department of Interior, however, does not allow us to review those applications at this time. So Sonoma County is frustrated, but we are not alone among county governments who are frustrated by the process by which lands are taken into trust. I appear before you today, as Mr. Kildee has said, on behalf of the California State Association of Counties. It's an organization that represents all 58 counties within California, in which more than 100 tribes have been recognized by the federal government, and in which there are about 70 pending trust land applications. We've submitted formal written testimony to the committee and to your staff expressing our concerns about the fee to trust process and making suggestions on how the process can be fixed. but we respectfully submit that the fee to trust process is broken, and that it is broken for all parties. It is fraught with uncertainty, delay, and conflict. A so-called simple carcieri fix does nothing to repair the underlying problems in the process. County governments are heavily impacted by fee-to-trust decisions. Trust acquisitions often increase demands for law enforcement, fire protection, health, social services, water, and other resources provided by counties without providing any mitigation for the burdens that are created. When land is placed into trust, as General Blumenthal said, it reduces the property tax base for counties, takes the property out of local land use jurisdiction. But despite these impacts, the Department of Interior does not provide sufficient notice regarding fee to trust applications, does not accord county concerns adequate weight in the process, and perhaps most egregiously, as determinations are made whether property qualifies as Indian land, which is a critical determination with respect to a gaming application, counties are not notified of such determination requests. We strongly believe that the process would benefit greatly from local participation to ensure that there is a complete factual basis on which to make an objective decision. The federal process is also flawed in that it does not require tribes to engage in good faith discussions regarding mitigation of environmental impacts of the tribal development or enter into enforceable mitigation agreements with local governments. Indeed, the Bureau of Indian Affairs will not even facilitate such discussions, and as it believes that its trust responsibility to tribes prevents it from fully engaging with local governments. These concerns are not just the concerns of California, but also expressed in the National Association of Counties platform, which has also been submitted to the committee. We submit that if Congress adopts a quick fix, it would be retreating from its constitutional role under the Indian Commerce Clause and would be delegating this critical function without adequate direction to the executive branch. A quick fix would perpetuate the problems that have resulted in years of expensive and unproductive conflict between tribes and local governments. We want a real and lasting fix. In our view, an amendment to the 1934 Act that extends tribal trust land authority to the Secretary of Interior should include, one, adequate notice to local government, two, a requirement to hear local government concerns, three, a requirement that tribes and local governments work together, and finally, to provide for cooperating agreements that are enforceable. The bills before you today fall short because they do not address the problems in the underlying trust process that have emerged during the last 75 years, and instead, they would authorize the Secretary to continue business as usual. California counties stand ready to work with this committee and with the administration to develop a new process that is founded upon mutual respect and encourages local governments and tribes to work together on a government-to-government basis in a manner that will benefit all parties. This is an historic opportunity. We urge you to work with counties across the nation to ensure that this opportunity is not missed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodside. Our next witness is Mr. Riaz Kanji of Kanji and Katzen on behalf of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Mr. Kanji.
Chairman Kildee, Ranking Member Hastings, honorable members of the committee, I very much appreciate the invitation to appear before the committee today. I speak here on behalf of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, a tribe well known to Chairman Kildee. I was accompanied by the band's chairman, the Honorable Derek Bailey, who unfortunately had to depart during the adjournment. I would like to touch very briefly on the band's history and use it to illustrate what I believe to be the compelling reasons why House Bills 3697 and 3742 should be reported favorably out of this committee and enacted into law. The band's history tracks the fact pattern that Chairman Kildee alluded to in one of his questions earlier. The United States first recognized the band in the 1795 Treaty of Greenville and then entered into a series of subsequent treaties with the band and other Michigan tribes in the 19th century, most notably the 1836 Treaty of Washington and the 1855 Treaty of Detroit. However, in 1872, Secretary of the Interior Columbus Delano, acting on his own, misread the 1855 Treaty of Detroit as calling for the termination of the relationship between the federal government and the signatory tribes. And from that point forwards, the Department of the Interior, acting without congressional blessing, ceased to recognize any of those signatory tribes. The consequences of that action for the Grand Traverse Band and its sister tribes were devastating. The band suffered through decades of increasing poverty and the destruction of its land base. But the band maintained its cohesiveness and identity as a Native American tribe and fought ceaselessly to be restored to federal recognition. Those efforts bore fruit in 1980 when the band was the first tribe to be acknowledged by the Department of the Interior under the new federal acknowledgement process. Because Congress never terminated federal jurisdiction over the tribe, because it maintained its cohesiveness as a Native American tribe, the band is confident that it can establish that it remained under federal jurisdiction in 1934, and hence even under the terms of the Carcieri decision, remains entitled to the protections of the IRA. However, the band strongly urges the enactment of 3697 and 3742 into law for several compelling reasons. First, it is unclear if or when the department will act on the band's submission that it remained under federal jurisdiction and on its pending trust applications. We hear a lot about the trust process. The Attorney General referred to it as lawless. I think it is important to remember that many land and trust applications, which are the lifeblood of tribal governments, are non-controversial, are non-gaming related. The band currently has 8 applications pending before the department. All are within the band's historic territory. All are contiguous to existing trust lands. None are for gaming purposes. None are objected to by the state of Michigan or by any local unit of government. But action on those is stalled and will remain stalled unless either the department acts or we get congressional action. Even if the department were to take favorable action, that would not relieve the band of the specter of years of seemingly endless litigation, which threatened to continue to disrupt the band's exercise of its sovereign powers. The attorneys general of 17 states in a letter to this committee in April signaled their intention to take a very cramped view of the Carcieri decision as holding that only those tribes that were actually federally recognized in 1934 are entitled to the protections of the IRA. Litigation over that or other theories could endure for a decade or more and could forestall favorable resolution of these issues. Just by way of illustration, the Carcieri decision itself was filed in July of the year 2000. As this committee knows, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in February of 2009. And as the committee further knows, that Supreme Court decision raised more questions than it answered. So failure to act with legislation could threaten tribes and other units of government with a decade or more of further litigation. It would be fundamentally unfair and serve no good purpose, I submit, to put the band and similarly situated tribes through another decade or more of disruption that would be engendered by further litigation over the meaning of the IRA. The band's history demonstrates in compelling fashion that it was not through any fault of its own, through none of its actions, through no issues having to do with its own identity, that it was not federally recognized as of 1934. To now deny the band the protections of the IRA or to force it and similarly situated tribes through another decade of litigation would simply compound the historical injustices suffered by the band as a result of decades of misguided federal action. The principal argument that we hear today and otherwise in opposition to the straightforward but fundamentally important corrective legislation that has been proposed is that the entire land in a trust process should be reexamined as part of any Carcieri fix. I think that is tantamount to arguing that where a patient comes into a hospital with a severely injured knee, the doctors should not operate on that knee, but should take critical time to instead examine other parts of the patient's body and decide whether action needs to be taken there. The bands, the tribes themselves, have fundamental concerns with the land into trust process. The tribes would support a reexamination of that process, but vindication of the fundamentally important principle that all tribes stand on an equal footing and are entitled to the protections of the IRA should not await that comprehensive reexamination, which could take years and which could just result in further delay and defeat. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.